At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense, political talk without the boring parts. I'm John Wiener. Today we'll speak with Lawrence O'Donnell, the MSNBC host. He says the 2016 election was bad, but 1968 was worse. That's when Nixon won, when the Vietnam War continued. And it's the subject of his new book. It's called Playing with Fire. Also, why are working class white people so angry? One well-known attempt at an explanation is the best-selling memoir Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance. But historian Stephen Hahn doesn't think much of the book. He'll explain why later in this hour. First up today, the resistance to Trump, year one. For that, we turn to David Cole. He's National Legal Director of the ACLU, a contributor to the New York Review, and legal correspondent for The Nation magazine. We reached him today at the ACLU office in New York City. David, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, now we're going to step back from the news of the day, the news of the week, to look back over the year since Trump got elected. Even though Republicans control both houses of Congress and two-thirds of state legislatures and now have a majority on the Supreme Court, you say Trump's ability to do damage has been substantially checked. Are you sure about that?
Well, I'm sure that it's been substantially checked. I don't think it's we can sit back and relax. But look, here's somebody who came to office with majorities in both houses of Congress, and as you said, majorities in most of the state houses as well for his party. He has yet to pass a significant piece of legislation, and he has been repeatedly frustrated in his ability to act through the legislature to put in place anything that would, constitute law. He has been able to act in areas where the executive can act independently, withdrawing various environmental protections and imposing things like the travel ban and the like. But those things, number one, are subject to challenge in the courts, and number two, are subject to being reversed when the next president is elected, who I'm quite confident will not be Donald Trump.
Well, let's talk about some of these key issues. Let me say my pet peeve is voting rights, the new voting restrictions that Republicans have been pursuing, not just Trump, but for more than a decade now, that helped make Trump president. And you and the ACLU have been fighting a vigorous battle on that front. And I'd just like to check on where we stand at this point, especially one of the most outrageous cases is Ohio's purge of the voting rolls. The state of Ohio removed people from the voting rolls who chose not to vote. And I know that you and the ACLU are challenging this in court. Where do we stand on this Ohio purge of the voting rolls?
So that is scheduled to be argued in the Supreme Court in January. We prevailed below in advance of the election, and the court, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, enjoined Ohio from, in fact, knocking people off the rolls for failing to vote, which is what they were doing. And many people were, thousands of people were able to vote who otherwise would not have been able to vote. For 20 years, the Justice Department, under both Republican and Democratic administrations, agreed with the position that we took in that case and that we and on which we prevailed. But once Trump was elected, the Justice Department reversed 20 years of precedent and is now on the opposite side, supporting Ohio's efforts to purge voters. That'll be argued probably in January.
This concept of failing to vote, I wonder if you'd like to reconsider the term failing.
I mean, it's a crazy, I mean, the idea, Congress passed something called the National Voter Registration Act, the Motor Voter Law, some time ago. And one of the things they were concerned about was states knocking people off the registration rolls and frustrating their ability to vote. And there were a number of states that did it. Simply, if you didn't vote in enough, you know, in enough elections, they presumed that you, you know, were either dead or moved, and they just knocked you off the rolls, even if you had were still breathing and just weren't, you know, inspired by the candidates. So Congress said you cannot have a system that results in the removal of a voter from the registration list for failing to vote. And one of the reasons they did that was because they said, you know, you have a constitutional right to vote. You also have a constitutional right not to vote.
You can't be penalized. You have a constitutional right not to vote as part of the right to vote, so you can't be punished for not voting by being removed from the voting rolls. I think the ACLU has a very convincing case here, and I guess so do the lower courts.
So are the lower courts. We'll see. We'll see how it goes in the Supreme Court. But that's a very important voting case going forward.
And what else is happening on the voting rights front?
Well, you know, the big thing is the Trump administration is following the playbook of the Republican Party, which is seeing that there are a lot of new demographics in this country, a lot of younger voters, a lot of voters of color. Who may not support the Republican Party, and instead of adjusting their policies to try to reach out to those voters, they search for ways to deny their access to the ballot. It's called voter suppression, and in their terminology, it goes under the name of preventing voter fraud. They haven't actually identified almost any voter fraud, but they nonetheless raise it as a bugaboo, as a justification to knock people off the rolls. And so Trump is sort of laying the groundwork for that, created this voter fraud commission headed up by Chris Kobach from Kansas, who is sort of the architect of voter suppression. And we've challenged the makeup of that commission. We've challenged the secretive way in which that commission has operated in the courts. And we were able, through the courts, to force Kobach to disclose documents that demonstrated that the entire purpose of this commission was, in fact, to lay the groundwork for suppressing the vote, for denying people access to the vote. So, you know, we're watching that very, very carefully, and we fully suspect that that there will be efforts at the state level to sort of do Trump's bidding, and we'll be there at each step to challenge those efforts.
We've talked several times on this program about the legal challenges to Trump's Muslim travel ban. I wonder where we stand at this point. I know the Ninth Circuit here in California just recently, the headline was allowed Trump's travel ban for people from six Muslim majority countries to go into effect partially. What exactly does that mean?
So, you know, this is the third iteration of the travel ban. The first iteration was struck down by the courts, including the Ninth Circuit. The Trump administration did not take that to the Supreme Court. Instead, they put out a second iteration. That, too, was struck down by the courts, including the Ninth Circuit in California, but also the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia. The administration took that up to the Supreme Court, but then issued travel ban 3.0 on the verge of oral argument in the Supreme Court. And so the case was sent back to the district courts to look at whether travel ban 3.0 is any different. So far, both the district court in Hawaii and the district court in Maryland have concluded that travel ban 3.0 is just as unconstitutional and just as illegal as travel bans 1.0 and 2.0. And that they are still an effort to basically put up a sign saying Muslims keep out, and that violates the Establishment Clause and is inconsistent with the Immigration Act. The government has appealed. Appeals are pending in the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit. What the Ninth Circuit's most recent order did was essentially conform the district court's injunction to, in the same way that the Supreme Court had done before, which is to draw a distinction between how it applies to people seeking visas who have a bona fide relationship with someone in the United States, meaning some family relationship or some relationship with a business or entity like an admission to a college or an offer of employment. Those people are protected, but people who have no bona fide relationship to anyone in the United States are not protected by the injunction, at least as it stands at this moment.
One of your most important arguments is that the courts can't stand up to President Trump alone, and we don't really expect them to do that. You see it as a much bigger struggle than simply the ACLU going before the Ninth Circuit.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, so I think understanding the travel ban and the response to the travel ban requires you to look not just at what's happened in the courts, not just at the arguments made, but at what happened outside the courts. You know, the unprecedented public outcry in response to the, you know, the very first travel ban, where tens of thousands of Americans, you know, rushed out to airports to protest the ban and to provide assistance to those who were affected by it. That same weekend, you had statements by Michael Hayden, who was the head of the CIA and the NSA, National Security Administration, under George W. Bush, saying, you know, how about that? I'm with the ACLU on this one. Dick Cheney said, this is un-American. John Yoo, who wrote the torture memos, said, this is an abuse of executive power. Dozens of former National Security and State Department officials of both parties filed briefs saying this undermines our security. The presidents of all the major American universities and all the leading science foundations and all of the leading tech companies filed either petitions or letters or amicus briefs challenging these bans. And so by the time the courts were taking these up, much of America had stood up in sharp criticism of these actions by the president. And that has an effect on the way, you know, the willingness, really, of the courts to stand up to the president on a matter of that is alleged to be a matter of national security and immigration. And in other areas, the people standing up have frustrated the president from even getting, you know, getting his laws enacted. So the town halls in which people came out and excoriated their representatives if they were, you know, not standing up to the effort to repeal Obamacare, and time and again that effort has failed. So, you know, I think when you look at the response from really, you know, the day after Trump's election to the Women's March, the day after the inauguration, to the airport demonstrations, to the outpouring of opposition to the ending of DACA, which has led Trump to sort of backpedal on that and say, well, I hope Congress can fix it, and if Congress doesn't fix it, maybe I'll extend it. I mean, all of these things are illustrations of the power of people in a democracy to push back against their leader when their leader is engaged in activities that are contrary to the people's will and to the principles and values of the country.
We've talked about the ACLU's work on voting rights and on the travel ban. What else is on your agenda as legal director of the ACLU?
Oh, well, there's so much else. We got two cases coming up in the Supreme Court in the next couple of weeks. And both of which the Trump administration on the other side. One is whether the police can get access to your cell phone location data, which shows where you travel on essentially a minute-by-minute basis, you know, 24/7, whether they can get access to that information without a warrant, without probable cause, without any Fourth Amendment constraints whatsoever. We have another case involving whether a bakery can refuse to serve a gay couple because it opposes same-sex marriage. They're claiming a First Amendment a right to discriminate. Again, the Trump administration has come in on the side of those seeking an exemption from an anti-discrimination law, we're seeking to enforce that anti-discrimination law. And we're still fighting the Trump administration over the policy, the outrageous policy of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, of blocking women who are authorized to get abortions from obtaining those abortions when they are undocumented minors being held in federal facilities.
David Cole, citizen action is the key to resisting Trump. David Cole is a legal correspondent for The Nation. He's a contributor to The New York Review, where he wrote about Trump year one. And he also happens to be national legal director of the ACLU. David Cole, thanks for all your work, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, John.
'68, that terrible year in American politics. Now it's the subject of a new book by Lawrence O'Donnell. We watch him, of course, weeknights on MSNBC on The Last Word. He's also been chief of staff of the Senate Finance Committee, executive producer on The West Wing, and he's also written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and other publications. His new book is terrific. It's called Playing with Fire, The 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. Lawrence O'Donnell, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So much happened in 1968. The Vietnam War was reaching a peak. There were almost 500,000 American soldiers fighting in Vietnam. The anti-war movement was reaching a peak. Millions of people were demonstrating in the streets. The Democratic Party was beginning to consider the possibility that the war was a terrible political mistake. So much happened in 68. Please run down for us the key events that culminated in Nixon narrowly defeating the Democratic candidate Hubert Humphrey that November.
Well, it's going to sound like a mini series because it is. and each one of the events I'm about to describe would have been the biggest event in any other campaign year. Yes. First of all, a Democratic senator, Eugene McCarthy, comes from out of nowhere and decides to challenge his party's president, Democratic President Lyndon Johnson, who is heavily favored for re-election. Gene McCarthy decides to go up to New Hampshire and challenge him in the primary. LBJ's name isn't even on the ballot in the primary because there's not supposed to be a primary. There's a Democratic president. There's no need for Democratic primaries. McCarthy goes up there, and I was a kid in high school at the time, and I thought he won because that's the sense that the campaign coverage conveyed, and it was literally decades later that I discovered, oh no, he came in second, but it was such a strong second that it shocked the political world. Days later, Bobby Kennedy jumps into the race. Bobby Kennedy had been thinking about running longer than Gene McCarthy had thought about running. He had thought about running, decided not to, thought about it again, decided not to again, and now Bobby Kennedy was jumping in. So now there were two challenges to the establishment Democratic president incumbent, two challenges from the left. And then we go on to see this battle between McCarthy and Kennedy, because LBJ wasn't really actively participating in the primary system, and most states didn't have primaries anyway. And then Martin Luther King gets assassinated, which stops everything and stops the campaign in its tracks for a while. Rioting breaks out all over the country. Bobby Kennedy has to announce to an audience in Indianapolis that night of the assassination of Martin Luther King what has happened. It's a black audience that came there to cheer Bobby Kennedy, and now they're crying, and one of the places rioting did not happen in the United States that night was the place where Bobby Kennedy personally made the announcement about Martin Luther King's assassination in Indianapolis. 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy is assassinated on the night that he wins the California primary and was, it seemed, on his way to go to Chicago to grab the nomination off of the momentum of the California win. He's assassinated, shot and is lying there on the floor of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. Gene McCarthy then becomes terribly disoriented now that Bobby Kennedy is out of the race and has left the race in the worst possible way. He kind of drifts through the summer. Hubert Humphrey, Lyndon Johnson's vice president, after Johnson drops out, decides to try to get the nomination himself. He doesn't run in a single primary, and he still gets the nomination by playing the inside game, what we would now call the superdelegate game, and gets the nomination simply by working the delegates in the hall. And you then have rioting outside the Democratic convention, which a commission that's commissioned to study the rioting after the fact calls a police riot. It's saying that the demonstrators would have been peaceful, but the police themselves decided to go into the demonstrators and attack them. You have chaos inside the convention hall, with Mayor Daley's security forces inside the convention hall throwing punches at network correspondents like Mike Wallace on the floor of the convention, Dan Rather being knocked to the floor of the convention. And it all ends with a proven case of collusion. Richard Nixon, the Republican nominee, believed he needed one thing more than anything else to win. He needed that on Election Day, the Vietnam War be going and going badly. And so he colluded with the South Vietnamese government, communicated directly, indirectly, I should say, through emissaries to the South Vietnamese government to not make any kind of peace moves at all, because hang on, Nixon will get a better deal for you than you will get with LBJ. And so the South Vietnamese government agreed to go to Paris to join the peace talks about a week before the election day, and Nixon intervened with them secretly and got them to change their minds, and then South Vietnam tells President Johnson, we're not going to go to Paris. Johnson discovers this. He discovers through the CIA and through FBI wiretaps exactly what Richard Nixon is up to. LBJ calls it treason when he sees what Nixon has been doing, and he threatens to make it public. He tells a Republican senator he just might make it public, tell the New York Times or the Washington Post what Richard Nixon has done.
Why didn't LBJ reveal what Nixon had done, or why didn't Hubert Humphrey? Why did they let him become president after Nixon committed what you call the worst crime in American political history?
Lyndon Johnson's own advisors, Defense Secretary, Secretary of State, tell him he can't do that because he would reveal their intelligence gathering methods in Washington, D.C., at the embassies, and other things that he would have to reveal in the process. And people might not believe him. They might just think this is a last-minute political attack. Yeah. And so Johnson goes through the anguish of that presidential decision and decides to keep it secret, and Nixon wins by less than 1% of the vote.
You have compared Trump today with Vietnam in 1968, and you said Trump is our Vietnam. You even said that it's bad today, but it was worse in 1968. Could you explain that?
Well, it's actually, it was a 22-year-old student who said to me that Trump is our Vietnam. After I was explaining, after the election, the day after the election, I was talking to some young college students, and they were saying this is how horrible this was, how horrible it felt to them. And I said, I tried to explain that it was worse in 1968. And they couldn't really comprehend that because they didn't live through it, and they haven't experienced the draft, and they don't know what it's like for their boyfriend to be shipped off to Vietnam and killed, or their brother, or to be drafted themselves and sent into combat. So they couldn't connect with it. But they heard what I was saying. And some of them said back to me, well, this is our Vietnam. And I think they're right in the sense that they felt completely alienated from government. They felt politics completely failed them in every conceivable way to deliver this horrible outcome in this election. And spiritually, that what they feel inside is similar to what we felt inside in 1968, a kind of hopelessness, and yet at the same time, a need to be heard and to protest. And so I think in that sense, this is the deepest, most personally felt alienation from government and protest of government since the Vietnam War.
Well, I remember 1968 vividly, too. I was a student. I was an SDS member. I remember what you describe as hopelessness when Nixon was elected. You know, we had worked so hard. We were so exhausted. It was such a despairing situation because now the Vietnam War was not going to end. Tens of thousands more Americans would get killed. Maybe a million Vietnamese were going to get killed. But you conclude that from the perspective of just 6 years later, this is a quote from your book, the peace movement won. I mean, looking at our sense of despair and hopelessness at the end of 1968, what do you mean the peace movement won?
Well, we have to understand the dimensions of the game, if we're going to call it that, when we're dealing with politics. And people often make this mistake of thinking it's won or lost in the election, or it's won or lost in 1 year, and it isn't. And I worked for Senator Moynihan. We one time had a member of the new cabinet who was being confirmed, and we had the sense that this guy would work in government for 2 years and then leave. And Senator Moynihan said to him, well, you know, there's no sense getting involved in this if you're not going to spend 30 years with it.
Wow.
And that's how you define crusades in politics and government. And so, no, the peace movement didn't win in 1968. But the Vietnam War ended when it ended, and the draft ended when it ended because Eugene McCarthy decided to run for president in 1968 and give the peace movement a spot on the presidential ballot for the very first time. And if he had not decided to do that, we would not have had our first peace candidate running for president until 1972, until 4 years later. So does that mean the Vietnam War would have lasted 4 years longer than it did? Does that mean that the draft would have lasted 4 years longer than it did? And I would submit to you, it definitely means it would have lasted longer. We have no idea how much longer. But because Gene McCarthy gave the peace movement its ballot initiative, as it were, in 1968, it started the clock ticking on the end of the Vietnam War. And if he waited another 4 years, if that didn't happen for another 4 years, we probably would have had another 4 years of death and destruction in Vietnam, and another, and tens of thousands more American soldiers killed in Vietnam, and possibly hundreds of thousands more Vietnamese killed.
Last question, one personal note. Where were you in 1968? Did you end up getting drafted? Did you go to Vietnam?
No, I was in high school in 1968 watching all of this on TV as the political coverage covered it. I then got a draft notice in 1972, and at the end of 1972, I had my physical. I had my physical in January of 1973, and usually after you pass the physical, as I did, about 2 weeks later you get something in the mail telling you where to report for duty. And I passed the physical, and a week after I passed the physical on January 27th, 1973, President Nixon ended the draft. I should say he was forced to end the draft. And so everyone who I stood with that day at the induction center in South Boston getting the physicals, none of those young men were drafted and went to Vietnam because the draft ended for us. And so they all have children, and many of them have children and grandchildren who are alive today who have no idea that they owe their lives to the peace movement that ended the draft in January of 1973 instead of January of 1974 or 75 or 76.
The book is Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. The author is Lawrence O'Donnell. Thank you for this terrific book, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Now,
Now it's time to talk about angry working class white people. We've heard a lot about them lately, and now we can read a lot about them. For that, we turn to Stephen Hahn. He teaches history at New York University. He's the author of many award-winning books, most recently A Nation Without Borders. Steve Hahn, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, we are told that angry working class white people, especially men, made the difference in getting Trump the electoral votes he needed in the key states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin to become president. And there are a bunch of new books about angry working class white people, which are said to explain what's happened to America. You've read a bunch of them. The top of the list, the most popular, the best known, is Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance. It's been on the bestseller list for 62 weeks. That's a year and 10 weeks. Who is J.D. Vance, and what is this book?
Well, J.D. Vance, as best as I can tell, and that's mostly from the book, grew up in a declining steel town in Ohio, but his family roots are in eastern Kentucky. His grandparents were born there, and they also moved out. And he ended up at Yale Law School, I think with a professor who may have been the one writing was the Tiger Mom, who encouraged him to write this. And I don't really know much more about it, but he's very young. He calls it a memoir, but he himself acknowledges how odd it is for a 31 or 2-year-old to write a memoir. But he certainly saw an opportunity to reflect on what he thought were his own experiences in this kind of arc of hillbilly culture to try to explain, you know, one of the important things that he thinks are going on, which has to do with the consequences of deindustrialization, how it's had a very adverse impact on white working folk.
You write in The Nation that Hillbilly Elegy, this massive bestseller, quote, has the feel of a college application essay, close quote. That's,
I mean, he raises an assortment of interesting questions, recognizing that the kind of migrations that his family underwent were common to a wide variety of Southerners, including African Americans. But he has no interest really in reflecting on them, and in fact prefers to use the story as something of a morality tale, and trading in caricatures that we tend to associate with the very people he discusses. And so they seem, you know, with the exception of his grandparents, to be pretty sort of thinly crafted people. And the story, of course, is his redemption from the, you know, sort of being grabbed from the jaws of disaster by his grandparents, and his own good fortunes of managing to get out of the morass he saw for the rest of his family and community, because his mother in particular was kind of caught in this situation. So I thought it was basically a pretty superficial rendering of what was going on, and because it was a story of how he managed to find his way out of it up against enormous odds.
Well, he writes about the people he calls hillbillies, who are violent and lazy and ignorant and sexist and angry at the political establishment and angry at Obama. What is his explanation of their
anger? Well, the thing that's remarkable about it is that he's very quick to dismiss race. Instead, he sees Obama as an example of the privilege that Democratic elites in particular have, and how this makes the hillbilly folk, which he both identifies with and kind of reviles, you know, feel a sense of inferiority. The last section of the book is kind of a reflection on contemporary politics and his ideas about, you know, where the Democratic Party went wrong and so on and so forth. And that's his take. His take is that a lot of the anger comes from a feeling that they've been passed over and that the advantages have gone to people like Barack Obama, who, not so much because he's black, but because, or a beneficiary of affirmative action per se, but rather because of his elite pedigree, seems to not only have offered him advantages, but remind them of the advantages that they don't have. At the same time, of course, he's very quick to talk about their own laziness and ignorance, so it's not as though he's trying to build a case for people who have, you know, tried to go down that route and have been blocked.
For people who want to understand white working class anger, is there a better book than the monster bestseller by J.D. Vance?
Well, one of the books that I reviewed is a comparative study of Youngstown, Ohio, and East London, England, by a guy named Justin Guest. And, you know, I think it's the best of the books I had an opportunity to write about, because he's really, I mean, it's not only a sort of a comparative study which helps us understand that we're looking at really a transatlantic phenomenon, and certainly what's happened in Europe over the past few years would confirm that. But he's also interested in recognizing that the whole construction of the idea of a white working class obscures the way in which categories tend to submerge other really important divisions, as is true, so that in Youngstown, in its heyday in the 60s and 70s, when it's an overwhelmingly white city and has a fairly prosperous white working class, that the white working class itself, you know, has many divisions along ethnic and cultural lines, that people who are regarded as white may be from the Middle East, they may be from Southern Europe, and so that these were issues that working people in Youngstown, Ohio, and especially in the steel industry, which was so formidable there, you know, struggled over themselves. So, you know, one of the things that is, I think, should be clear is that this, you know, the white working class is not an analytical category, but a sort of cultural and political construction that is meant for us to kind of have to understand some of the important political divisions that take place, but it doesn't offer us very much information as to who these people are, what they do, and why we even call them working class.
What exactly does he mean by the title, the new minority, if he doesn't have a concept of a unitary white working class?
What he tries to argue is that there's this, what he calls a sense of minoritization. And I think one of the, you know, the tensions in the book is between his recognition that the so-called white working class is not homogenous, and the idea more recently that white working people, people who had been employed in steel mills or were the children of people who had been comfortably employed in steel mills, have increasingly got a feeling, because not necessarily because of their numbers, but because of their lack of access to power, that they too have become a new minority. He does recognize too that that doesn't foreordain any specific politics, and that he tries to suggest that there are two or three routes people do politically who are regard themselves as in this situation, one of which is to express rage and contempt for the established politics, but it's not the only one.
And what are the other routes beyond, or aside from, let's call it Trumpism?
Right. Well, what he suggests is that some of them withdraw from politics entirely, and others actually try to find their way within established political institutions. So that the third is what the media tends to call, you know, sort of populist, which is doesn't have any program, which doesn't necessarily have any clear party connection, but is mostly governed by a sense of betrayal and outrage and feeling that the established political structures are no longer adequate to deal with their problems, a sense of powerlessness.
what about populism with a more progressive political content like Bernie Sanders? Does he consider this a significant potential for the people he's writing about in Youngstown?
Well, this book came out before the Sanders phenomenon, so he really doesn't take this on. And he is not all that interested. I mean, he uses this minoritization as his, you know, main concept. So it's not really built around, I mean, populist is something that he, a label he uses to refer only in part of the book to this sort of sense of anger and rage that he sees mostly anti-establishment. And, you know, I don't think that any of the other works really offer much of a way of thinking about this. I mean, it strikes me that the media has played a pretty bad role in, you know, suggesting that this, you know, populism is a useful way to think about much of what is going on, because it's kind of a stand-in for ignorant people who don't know what they're doing and yes. are just pissed off. You know, how we got from populism in the late 19th century, which was a political party and people called themselves populists, and they did have a program, and, you know, they had, you know, had their bad behavior as well as good behavior, but it was an attempt to readjust the balances of power in the industrializing United States, and how you get from that to a kind of small p populism that I think has been shaped by the tendency of movements and phenomena we call populists to be more right-wing.
Steve Hahn wrote for The Nation magazine about the rage of white folk, how the silent majority became a loud and angry minority. You can read him at thenation.com. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, John. It's really nice to be on the show.
Finally, a word about Dave Zirin's Edge of Sports podcast, where sports and politics collide. Hosted by the sports editor of The Nation and featuring Dave Zirin's interviews, his commentary, and his rants. So even if you're a sports fan who hates politics or a political junkie who hates sports, you'll find something to love in this podcast. It's posted every Tuesday now at thenation.com/edgeofsports. Start Making Sense, the weekly podcast of The Nation magazine, is recorded and edited by Lyra Smith at the studios of Emerson College Los Angeles, located in the heart of Hollywood, with additional production help from Justin Allen. Alan Minsky is our senior producer. Our executive producer is Frank Reynolds. Annie Shields is our engagement editor. Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com. and subscribe to Start Making Sense at iTunes, Pocket Casts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.